Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Our call today will be on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Jendai Fraser with us today to discuss the conflict between Sudan and South Sudan. Ambassador Fraser is Adjunct Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at CFR. She's also Distinguished Public Service Professor at Carnegie Mellon University with joint appointments in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences and the H. John Hines School, College's School of Public Policy and Management. She is the director of Carnegie Mellon Center for International Policy and Innovation and the co-editor of Preventing Electoral Violence in Africa. She comes to CFR having served as a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs from 2005 to 2009. She was Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council from 2001 until her swearing in as the first woman U.S. Ambassador to South Africa in 2004. Ambassador Fraser, thank you very much for being with us today. There has been a lot reported about the tension between the two Sudans for a long time now. It would be great if you could give us an overview of the conflict and the current state of affairs between the two and the way forward that you see.
Well, thank you very much, Irene, for the introduction and for setting up this dialogue. And I also want to thank the participants for taking time to engage on the question of how do we prevent conflict between the two Sudans, the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan. Let me just state right up front that this may not be possible, that is to prevent conflict between the two countries, especially in the short term, and by that I mean 1 to 3 years. And I make this point because the dynamic between the two countries and within each country lends itself to continued conflict in the immediate future. And perhaps what we're really looking at is trying to prevent violent conflict or reduce the violence. But the tension between the two countries, I think, will remain for quite some time. And I say this because there's three main challenges to preventing conflict in Sudan. First is the history First is the history of the countries, the history of Sudan from its very independence in 1956. It was basically the new Arab-led Khartoum government reneged on promises to Southerners to create a federal system, which led to a mutiny by Southern Army officers that launched the first 17-year civil war between 1955 and 1972. So there's been a long tradition or history of conflict between these two peoples. The Second Sudan Civil War lasted from January 1983 until July 2002 with the Machakos Protocol on the role of the state and religion and the right of Southern Sudan to self-determination, which led to the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement that set the course for the January 2011 referendum for self-determination and the birth of the Republic of South Sudan in July 2011. So for more than three-quarters of the history of the Republic of Sudan, it has been a history of violent civil war. The Northerners, and this is the result of the Northerners attempting to impose Arabism and Islam on the population of Sudan, and also the marginalization of the people in the West, in Darfur, and in the East, the Beja. So I think that the dynamics within Sudan continue of authoritarian rule, a failure to fully share power and wealth with all of its citizens, and a reliance on the military as a means to repress the population. This has created a dynamic that spills over into the new Republic of South Sudan, creating or maintaining an environment that leads to conflict. In fact, specifically, the government is fighting with its own people in South Kordofan, especially the Nuba Mountains, and in blue now, and more than 170,000 refugees as a result have fled over the border into Sudan. So one of the keys to preventing conflict in between these two countries, the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan, is reform in the north or reform in the Republic of Sudan. And I would say that that is actually a fundamental area for focus of the international community, which I'll come into at the end in my conclusions when I talk about what I see as the way ahead. Now, when you look at that, so that's the first challenge to preventing conflict is change in the in Republic of Sudan. When you look at the Republic of South Sudan, it also has a legacy that lends itself to continued conflict with the Republic of Sudan. Specifically, traditionally, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which is the governing party of the Republic of Sudan, is allied with the marginalized people who have been left in the north. They see them as their brothers, and they're not prepared to turn their back on them. And in particular, they are aligned with or allied with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, which is indeed fighting the government. And if you look at the maps, if you were able to print out the maps, you can see the map of the Republic of Sudan, basically the north, where it shows South Kordofan with the Nuba Mountains and Blue Now, which is where SPLM North is operating from. And they are aligned also with the Darfurian rebel groups in South Darfur. And so you have continued fighting in the north on that border spilling over into the south, and the south sympathetic, of course, to the people who, after their secession, were left behind. So they're not going to turn their backs on the people of North Sudan, the marginalized people of North Sudan. And so this key, again, points to reform in the north as necessary. Secondly, in addition to their allegiance, they feel that a truce with Sudan would be a betrayal of these groups. And then the second issue is there's division among the Republic of South Sudan's ethnic groups. And this is partially a legacy of destabilization by the Republic of Sudan, the North. There's been a long history of the North, the Khartoum government, arming and pitting southern tribes against each other. There are over 200 ethnic groups in the Republic of South Sudan with a population of about 8.3 million people. So the meddling of the North is quite easy, and it's made easier based on a dynamic in which there's a perception that within the new Republic of South Sudan, power and wealth are not necessarily being equally distributed among those various ethnic groups. And there's a sense, and I say a perception, that there's Dinka dominance of government positions, and there's some resentment. And it's imperative that the new government of South Sudan establish good governance as a key to its own stability, its prosperity, and its viability. And to as a means to preventing ongoing conflict, both internal to its own borders and across those borders with the Republic of Sudan. We have to remember that the new Republic of Sudan came to independence with really underdeveloped institutions for governance and the capacity to serve the welfare of its citizens. So it's trying to establish itself as a new state with some capacity at the same time that it has this hostile border situation with the government. So the first challenge is the first challenge, which, you know, is also a background to the conflict between the two countries, is this issue of patterns of governance within each country, the legacy of engagement that undermines future peaceful coexistence. And I'm not by this saying that they're trapped by their history, but that the path set in the past has will require serious engagement on both sides to overcome what has been a legacy of conflict and violent conflict at that, both between the two peoples and now within the two states. The second challenge is more specific and comes out of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, again, that was signed in 2005. There were a number of unresolved issues that took place, and two in particular that have led to today's conflicts are oil revenue sharing and border demarcation. And it's worth remembering that when these two countries, when the South succeeded in July 2011, 75% of the oil fields now have gone to the South, while the pipeline to export that oil goes out through the North. And so this has led to a conflict over the price that the North will charge the South to export, basically the oil transit fees. And they've disagreed, and this is the current one of the current issues that have been negotiated in Addis Ababa. Because of that conflict, the Republic of South Sudan decided to shut in oil. They basically charged the North with stealing their oil, and in January 2012, they shut off production of oil, which has, of course, hurt the export earnings of both countries, which significantly rely on those oil revenue. So the oil revenue sharing issues are a continuing source of tension. Second is border demarcation. The border was never demarcated by the British during colonial rule, and that has led to continuing clashes today. Since the Republic of South Sudan came into existence, there was an escalation of border clashes, especially in April 2012, which people felt could lead to a return to war when the Southern Army went into Higlik, which is an oil town, and that Sudan claims. So you essentially have 1,200 miles of common border that has been undemarcated, and there are major oil fields along that border. One area that is especially noteworthy is that of Abyei. Abyei is oil rich, and again, if you look at your maps, you will see that Abyei sits right directly on the border between South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan, and the Republic of Sudan. The challenge of Abyei is also that you have two people who are, again, aligned with the two different countries. You have the Messeria, who are nomadics, who move in and out of Abyei, and they are aligned with the North and, in fact, have been armed by the North in the past. And then you have the Nyok Dinka, who are more sedentary and have always been aligned with the South. The Abyei was a special region within the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and it was supposed to hold its own separate referendum to decide its fate, whether it was going to be part of the North or whether it was going to be part of the South. Unfortunately, that referendum never took place, and part of the reason it didn't take place is because there was a challenge over who actually participates in the referendum, and particularly with the Messeria being nomadics coming in and out, who do you count as legitimate voters to decide the fate of that region? Now, the breaking news, of course, of this weekend, especially of today, is that the negotiations that were taking place between the two countries and, in fact, by the two leaders, President Salva Kiir of the Republic of South Sudan and President Omar al-Bashir of the North, the Republic of Sudan, they basically agreed today that they were going to resume oil exports from South Sudan, which will be a huge relief on both economies. They've agreed to a demilitarized zone between their borders and a cessation of hostilities to try to prevent the type of escalation of conflict that happened in April. And they also agreed to allow their citizens to move freely in each country, basically to move between the countries, to reside in the countries, and to work in the countries. So this is really quite good news. What they did not agree to, however, is the status of Abyei. And there was also no agreement on sort of the demarcation of that shared border. So those are two areas that are hugely important and will continue to lead to tensions, if not outright conflict. Now, one of the challenges here, it's good news today, but they're, again, looking at the Sudans, the two Sudans in history, is that they've had agreements before that have only partially been implemented and in some cases not at all. And so it's going to take significant engagement of the international community to ensure that these agreements, you know, even if they're not the final solution, are actually carried forward. So that's the second challenge, is the specific issues that were left unresolved by the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And then I mentioned the role of the international community, and I actually consider this the third challenge. And it's the third challenge because there's a huge international presence that's been working on Sudan for, gosh, more than 20, 30 years. I mean, almost from the very beginning of the history of the country, the 1972 peace agreement that ended the first 17-year war was negotiated in Addis Ababa as well. So there's just been a long legacy of international engagement to try to resolve the problems of Sudan. And so, you know, we can take comfort in that when we look at the solution, that there's going to be a continued engagement of the international community. Sometimes it's too many people, and especially the North has become very adept at form shopping, going back and forth between different negotiators to try to get the best deal for themselves or to get no deal at all. In this case, between the negotiations between the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan are being carried forward by the African Union high-level panel, which is chaired by former president of South Africa, Mbeki, and is very much supported by the regional countries and the UN. So in some ways, it's at least one form helps achieve results, and I think we see that today. But my own concern is that the international community seems to have adopted this position in which they're, you know, they are trying to take what they would consider a balanced view. They threaten sanctions against the South, and they threaten sanctions against the northern government and the southern government. And as I see it, the biggest challenge here is actually the Republic of Sudan. And its tendency to try to resolve its conflict through military means. The Republic of South Sudan is not as much using sort of military violence to resolve its problems with the Republic of Sudan. And so I think that this even-handed approach, while theoretically makes sense, I, for one, feel that it removes the responsibility from the party that is actually the main aggressor here. So, if I were looking at what to do, what should be the road ahead, particularly for the two countries, I would think continue engagement in the negotiations. That's absolutely crucial. I would argue for a stronger hand by the international community against the North, particularly the war that the North is carrying out against its own population in the South. I'm talking about the southern part of the Republic of Sudan, and that has led to the continued crisis between the two countries. If I were the southern government, the Republic of South Sudan, I would reorient my economy towards the east, i.e. right now the Republic of South Sudan is an observer member of the East Africa community. They're looking at building an oil pipeline going out through the east. That'll take some time. It'll take a very long time, actually. So to carry out that reorientation of my economy, I would engage in a strategic pause with the Republic of Sudan, and I would use the negotiations as a means for that strategic pause. But over the long term, try to build some type of rapprochement with the Republic of Sudan. But in the immediate term, high tensions are likely to continue, and there's some fundamental issues, many of them flowing from the way in which the North governs, that will continue to create crises between the two countries. And so with that, I'd like to conclude and welcome your questions as well as our discussion.
Terrific. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful overview and analysis. Let's open it up to questions from the students.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Eileen, University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, Ambassador.
Yes.
When you were first discussing the first challenge to avoid conflict, you suggested that there should be significant reform on North Sudan, on the Republic of Sudan. What kind of reform did you have in mind?
Well, first and foremost, as I said, I think that it's a matter of governance. It's the way in which the North governs, and they are moving more and more towards keeping power in the hands of those who are personally loyal or have tribal allegiances. And so they need to, transform their governance so that they incorporate the demands, the legitimate demands of the people of Darfur in particular, but also create an environment in which the people of their south, now in South Kordofan and in the Nuba Mountains, feel that they're part of the government. And part of this is their ideology, this ideology of Arabization and Islamization. And so I think that, they have to, let me step back. Between the North and the South, after the 2005 peace agreement, before the Republic of Sudan chose the option of self-determination, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement said that the North needed to make themselves attractive to the Southerners so that they would, the Southern population, so that they would feel that they were part of the polity, they were part of society, and that they would govern in a fair fashion. It's the same dynamic now in the North where the small clique that's in power needs to open up governance so that its own people feel that they're a part, they have a stake in remaining in Sudan, that they have a piece of the pie, that they can engage in the governance of the country. Without that, you're going to see, and there's some within the National Congress Party, which is the governing party, who felt that the succession of the Republic of South Sudan, basically their south, is going to lead to the complete disintegration of the North, because then the Darfurians will want to succeed, the Easterners will want to succeed. And that dynamic is not about the people. It's about how they govern. And so attention to power sharing, attention to wealth sharing, and creating an environment in which people want to feel that they're part of, they have a stake in the future of that country.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ohio State University.
Don does not seem to be the aggressor in this situation. However, I'd just like to ask, do you feel that if South Sudan had the military might to be able to do things like back up statements like calling Sudan full of insects or to actually hold a hag leg when they move in to occupy, do you feel that South Sudan could be an aggressor? Do they have that aggressive personality and just don't have the means to back it up?
No, I don't think South Sudan has an aggressor personality. I think that for much of their history, despite, John Garang, who was the first leader, the major leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement that negotiated the comprehensive agreement, John Garang felt that they should remain a unified Sudan, and he actually wanted to transform Sudan and its governance. But most of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement just wanted to escape. They just wanted to get out of the reach of the North. They wanted to get out of the reach of this imposition of an Arab Islamic identity on all Sudanese. They did not want to be governed by Sharia law. And so they were really trying to escape it. And I think that that still is their posture. I don't feel that it's an aggressive or offensive posture. I think that if they had, a stronger military capability, it would be used to defend themselves, not to try to take territory or to overthrow the North. Now, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement of the North, which is aligned with the Republic of South Sudan, they are pursuing right now a strategy of regime change. They feel that, you know, the National Congress Party has lost its legitimacy, and that their only way to change the governance of the North is by removing that party from government. And now, you know, that's based on a long history. I don't think that they have the capacity to do that, and so that's why I think it's for the international community, which is spending so much time focused on this sort of false conflict over unresolved issues between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan. It needs to refocus its attention on transformation of the Republic of Sudan, because until you have transformation in the North, in that Republic of Sudan, it's very difficult to achieve lasting peace between the two countries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Florida A&M University.
Yes, I just wanted to know, you were talking about having the oil revenue go out from the east. If you actually had the revenue go out from the east, would that end up cutting the North out of any type of oil funds?
Yes, well, the under the CPA, there was an agreement to split tax revenue from oil and gas exploitation by 50-50. For a period of time, the Sudan should still be able to get, they should still be able to get revenue from the oil. Now, there's a specific case right now that the Republic of Sudan has brought against the Republic of South Sudan, in which they have said that the Republic of South Sudan has illegally nationalized one of the state oil companies. And so I think that this issue, I think the fundamental problem here is that there could be an arrangement, and there was through the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, but both sides lack trust. And so certainly this would be considered a threat to the Sudanese, to the Republic of Sudan. Reorient the pipeline to the east would definitely be considered a threat to them. But that, to me, would be motivation for them to try to engage in less conflict with the Republic of South Sudan so that they can create an environment in which the two countries coexist, because there's some dependency that they have on the South, on the Republic of South Sudan.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from University of Richmond.
Hi, what continued impact do you believe that the Arab Spring will have on Bashir's regime, and do you believe that this could be an impetus for the internal political changes that you believe are necessary within the Republic of Sudan?
Well, Bashir has typically governed through, he himself was a military man, and he, came to power through a coup d'etat originally. And he has maintained the support of the military. So there's a lot of talk about sort of internal divisions within the National Congress Party, and particularly after the succession of South Sudan, in which some parts of the party didn't agree with that and others agreed, as well as some tension between Bashir and his military when he tried to, continue to use the military to suppress the populations in the South, and the military pushed back a bit. And so I'm not so sure that it's people in the streets that would push, that would create the dynamic of change in the governance as much as it is the disintegration of the ruling governing coalition that will lead to that change. So my sense is that the dynamic for change is more likely to come from within the failure of the National Congress Party versus the pressure from the public as a whole. But, if I were SPLM North, I would certainly try to move towards that type of, civil engagement versus, armed struggle, because armed struggle, they're very unlikely to succeed with armed struggle.
Our next question comes from Penn State University.
Hi, Dr. Fraser. I had a question regarding the DMZ you mentioned between North and South Sudan. My question is three-parted. What is the current makeup of the DMZ, and do you feel it will reach the level of North and South Korea's DMZ border? And if it does reach that level, what steps will need to be taken to rectify the situation?
Well, there isn't a DMZ at this point. That was the agreement that was taken in Addis Ababa that was made today or, you know, yesterday, but announced today. And the announcement says that the border would, that both armies will pull back about 6 miles from the frontier, and special arrangements would be made for a strategic strip of land called Mile 14. But, you know, the actual implementation of that agreement, we will have to, you know, get greater details. This is just what has been reported on what would be the demilitarized zone. So I don't have any additional details at this point.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next question comes from Global Affairs.
From Sudan. I appreciate your well-informed presentation. One of the challenges that you mentioned is the engagement of the international community, which brings me to my question on mediation. How effective are regional organizations such as the AU when it's often criticized to having a weak mandate and ineffective, as well as other organizations like IGAD, to ensure that the conflict is diffused? And can you also please touch upon the role of China, since it's an important economic partner to both the states?
Sure. I think that regional organizations play a very important and critical role in negotiations to end conflict and diffuse conflict. And I believe so because one of the challenges of all of these conflicts is normally the parties get support from neighboring countries. And so, you know, in some ways, having the region unified around a negotiating position and a mediator prevents the use of their territory and their governments dividing and backing different sides. And so I think it in and of itself, it may not be the purpose, but there's the unintended consequence of having regional mediation leading to a more unified stance within the neighboring countries in the neighborhood. And so the African Union, I think, has gained a lot of experience, and certainly as an institution, it has the legitimacy to be able to create that one forum and to align its members behind a mediator like Thabo Mbeki. So I think that that's a very positive dynamic. And obviously, you know, these regional institutions will gain more experience over time, and I think the African Union has been doing quite a good job across the continent. It doesn't always work, but it's working very well in the case of Sudan. And I also think as part of that, when you have a strong state within the regional organization that takes a leadership role and is recognized as doing so, you also have the more chances for success. And in this case, that would be Ethiopia, which has played that very, very strong role backing Thabo Mbeki's mediation, Thabo Mbeki being a South African. We saw this as well with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed in 2005. Those negotiations started in 2002, and the mediator at that time was a man named General Sombweyo, who was Kenyan, and the Kenyan government, of course, backed his mediation. But so did the United States, and that was under the regional organization, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development. And so that was the entity. A Kenyan was a mediator, and the international community, especially the United States, came in behind to back it. And so I think it's that type of dynamic that makes regional organizations more effective in the mediation. There was a second part to your question.
On the role of China since it's an economic partner to both states, shouldn't they also play a more valuable role in mediation?
Yes, I think China has an essential role that it can play here. China, you know, it tends to try to stay out of these political conflicts. They are mainly interested in the resources of the country and in engaging the countries economically. But I think the two international countries, that have the most influence in resolving the problems between North Sudan or the Republic of Sudan and South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan, is China and the United States, because the United States has been more aligned, as you know, with the Southerners, and the Chinese have very much supported the Northern government, mainly because the Northern government had control over the oil fields before the referendum and the secession. And so China certainly can play an important role, and I think that they are, you know, we have to encourage them and continue to encourage them to do so. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, I understand, spends quite a lot of time going to China. And, you know, before Princeton Lyman, Andrew Natsios, who was a special envoy under President Bush, and, you know, the other envoys, have slowly pulled China into engagement. And I think the Chinese recognize their role and will continue to play a more important role in it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Washington University.
Thank you, Ambassador Frazier. It's probably adding on to the last question, but for long-term security, securing that, it seems like the issue of trust is the main issue.
Yes.
And should that be resolved between the two countries, or if other countries do become involved in making that issue of trust better, are other countries in agreement?
Well, yes, you're right. Trust is fundamental. It's a fundamental problem, and it's not going to be built easily. And you know, I, for one, can understand Southern Sudan being very suspicious of the intentions and the motivations of the North, given their history. So over time, you have to build trust, and that's why I said I would start from a pragmatic position of a strategic pause. And that means that the Republic of South Sudan is going to have to sacrifice. It's going to have to sacrifice some of its principles from the point of view of supporting its brothers, especially in a military fashion. They can continue to support them politically and speak out for them diplomatically. But they are going to have to ensure that the use of their territory for military engagement is curtailed, and it's hard for me to say that because I understand the struggle that the people of Northern Sudan, the SPLM, the people of Nuba Mountains and others, I understand the crisis that they're under having been attacked by the Northern Army. But that said, there needs to be a strategic pause, and that strategic pause would be pragmatic. But over time, it can help build that confidence, build the trust that's necessary between both countries. But it's the patterns of behavior doesn't lend themselves to trust between the two countries.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from University of Texas.
Hello, and thank you for the call. I actually have a two-part question. The first is, what issues do you see being successfully negotiated over the next 1 to 3 or 5 to 10 years, and which do you think are the most intractable? And the second part of the question is, what issues do you think need to be in the negotiations immediately?
Yes, that's a hard question and a very, very good question. I think that the hardest issue is going to be demarcation of the border and the status of Abyei. And I would say true demarcation of the border that both sides agree to is a 5 to 10 year process. Now, it has to start now, and, you know, I'm not saying that the negotiations will take 5 to 10 years, but that the process of getting a border in place that both sides agree and respect is probably a more longer-term proposition, a 5 to 10 year. And I would put the status of Abiy in the 1 to 3 years, but understanding that it is actually essential, and again, one of the more difficult issues to resolve. But I think it's critically important. The issue of the oil revenue, I think that's a 1 to 3 year proposition. I think that's likely to be resolved rather quickly. It's a formula. It's a formula that both sides are going to have to come to, and they can be supported by a lot of technical expertise coming globally to help them come up with what is a fair deal and what is a deal that reflects the standards of the industry. This is not an unknown problem, and so I think that that probably is one that is more easily resolved. Of course, one that also is resolved is the status of citizens especially Southerners who have been left over in the Republic of Sudan, and do they have rights of citizenship in the Republic of Sudan? That should be one that can be resolved, again, in the 1 to 3 year framed time frame, and, in fact, sooner than later. So I'm trying to think if there are other issues that are outstanding. But I think those are the main ones. And demarcation is a longer-term proposition, demarcation that is accepted. And the status of Abiy I would put as medium-term, and I would put oil revenue as short-term.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Northeastern University.
Yeah, I was wondering how useful you think the UN presence has been in South Sudan in terms of building up the governance in construction of a new state.
That's a question that I don't know. I don't know. The UN presence anywhere, I think, in the world, particularly as I've witnessed it in Africa, is sort of a double-edged sword. And I say that because they tend to become very entrenched. They don't put themselves out of work. And that entrenchment means that a level of dependency is easily developed. And also a culture of unrealistic expectations can be developed. And I say that from the point of view of the Land Rovers and the lifestyle that, you know, many of the UN employees are living, and, you know, it creates aspirations among the population as well, and resentment among the population. So those are sort of broad, general perspectives about the role of the UN anywhere. Now, obviously, the UN plays a critically important role in, one, you know, trying to improve the security of the population, and certainly from a humanitarian perspective of, you know, all of these refugees providing for their basic needs, the population and the ones who are coming from the north out of conflict, providing for their basic needs and their housing, helping to guide, I would say, hopefully with a lighter hand than a heavier hand, the new government and its efforts to set up its institutions. And so on the day-to-day basis, I think the UN plays an extremely important role and a very constructive role. But from the broader strategic or longer-term perspective, I think the UN doesn't work consciously enough to put itself out of business. It becomes a permanent, a permanent presence that creates longer-term dependency.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Johns Hopkins University.
Hi, Hi, Ambassador Fraser. Thank you so much for your presentation. We learned a lot. I had two questions for you, actually. The first has to do with the international community in terms of the patterns of governance you were saying. So in terms of the government of Sudan, they also didn't really start off on a good start when it comes to their own governance. You know, in May of this year, they announced that they kind of admitted that they lost $4 billion to their own government officials and their troop buildup, you know, and they ended up catching it in early April. So I was wondering, how could the international community also send a strong signal, and the U.S. as well, send a strong signal to the government of Sudan in terms of improving its own governance? And the second quick question I had was on the demilitarized zone, because earlier on we saw the border committee, and, you know, we realized it was more of a technical and not it was more of a political problem because there was a lot of delays created by both sides and it was a lot of a political stalemate. So how do you think that today's events with the demilitarized zone buffer is going to be any different in terms of implementation? Thank you so much.
Could you say that last question again? You were a little bit coming in and out there.
Sure. Just about the demilitarized zone buffer that was announced today as the deal. And we're seeing before, over the past 6 years after the CPA with the Technical Border Committee and whatnot, that it kind of fell victim to a lot of political plays between the North and the South, and both had their reasons for stalling the process. So it became a very political one. So how do you think this piece of news today is really going to change anything?
Right. Great question. First, on the role of the international community and what kind of signals can be sent for improving governance in the North, I thank you for that question. And it gets back to my point, and that is essentially we are muting, I believe the international community in some ways is muting its voice about the problems in the Republic of Sudan because it's trying to pursue this even-handedness. You know, this posture of being even-handed between the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan as a means to push forward the negotiations over the unresolved issues of the CBA and to diffuse the April conflict over Higlik. And so the even-handed posture actually undermines us taking a very strong and decisive posture towards the Republic of Sudan. And that's where I think there's a failure. You know, there's a dynamic that can lead to a failure to actually resolve this problem over the long term in an effort to try to seem to be fair in the short term. And so I would say that the special envoy, the U.S. special envoy, should be spending a lot of time in Khartoum. He should be, you know, the U.S. Congress should be calling hearings about the Republic of Sudan, not about the tension between the two countries, but about the war that's going on, that continues to go on in the north, about the fact that Darfur continues to be unresolved to this day since the rebellion in 2003, you know, to essentially establish a bilateral relationship with the Republic of Sudan that has nothing to do with the two countries' relationships between themselves, but is more about the U.S. government and what its interests are in seeing transformation to a more sustainable nation within the Republic of Sudan by its incorporating all of its people in power and wealth sharing. And so, you know, even-handed, forget about it. It shouldn't be our policy. Our policy should be focused on challenging the North. And you know, it's a policy that has been bipartisan, and it's been across administrations. And we should not lose our focus. And then we should spend our time with South Sudan, you know, embracing them as our traditional allies, but encouraging them to establish a type of governance that they fought for. You know, they were fighting against the North because they were marginalized. They were fighting against the North because they were excluded from. Well, they were fighting against the North because the rule of law was not fair. And so if they had spent all of these years, more than 20 years, fighting for that against the North, then they should have a natural disposition to create a society that's more equitable internally. And so, you know, we spend so much time trying to create rapprochement between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan that we're losing our focus, that these are two separate states that require, individually designed policy from the U.S. government, bilateral policy from the U.S. government. Now, on the demilitarized zone and buffer, I agree with you that we have seen that, you know, with the CPA Technical Border Committee and, you know, that these two countries will, as I had said, only partially implement agreements according to their own interests, according to their own politics, according to their own posture at any moment in time. So, you know, I don't want to be negative, so I have to look at the details of what has been agreed. I haven't seen the full details. I am a skeptic. Going back to the point that was made earlier about fundamental trust and, you know, demilitarized zone and buffer zones where you don't have a transformation of the underlying relationship are very, very difficult to implement effectively. And you see this, frankly, between Ethiopia and Eritrea. And the continuing crisis over demarcation of their border and their demilitarized zone. So I'm a skeptic about outside of some, you know, obviously serious engagement by the international community, but some fundamental transformation of the relationship that this is the key to, you know, and no one said it was the key, but, you know, it's certainly not going to be the key to the success. It's resolving the real issues, i.e. demarcating the border.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Coastal Carolina University.
Good afternoon, Ambassador Frazier.
Yes.
How strong do you see the agreement between the North and South, and do you think it will be lasting? And also the pipeline situation, the only area that I can foresee a pipeline having positive effects would be to Kenya. Are they willing to go along with this?
In the agreement, are you talking about the current, the one that was announced today, or
the newest one, today's?
Yes, I think both countries have an interest in restarting the oil. So I think that you know, it's going to take some time to get the oil up and running again. Some people say even to the end of the year. So I think that they probably have mutual self-interest in that taking place, and so I see that being, that definitely being implemented. We just talked about the demilitarized zone and what impact it will have and how it will be implemented and, you know, what forces will be put there. And so I suspect that that's going to be a mixed record actually having a demilitarized zone. And if they don't ultimately resolve the status of Abyei, I think that the issue about the free movement of citizens back and forth within each country is going to be problematic as well. So parts of the agreement more than likely will be implemented and implemented fully. Other parts only in a mixed way until some more fundamental issues are addressed. On the second question of the pipeline and whether Kenya agrees, yes, Kenya very much agrees to having the South Sudan pipeline. It's going to be a question of feasibility ultimately and cost and who bears that cost. But Kenya is preparing itself, in fact, for the South Sudan, you know, putting a pipeline through its country. And so the East African community is very much aligned with the Republic of South Sudan, supportive of the Republic of South Sudan, and interested in the trade and economic relationships mutually beneficial trade and economic relationships, because the Republic of South Sudan has huge potential, not only because of its oil revenue, but also because of its agricultural potential as well. There are a number of Kenyan traders and Ugandan traders already operating in Juba and in the south, and one would hope that as the institutions are really established, that the economy can be a diversified one, not just dependent on oil, and one that helps build the regional, prosperity of the economic community as a whole.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from University of Pittsburgh.
Thank you. I would like to know from your standpoint if the persistence of this conflict may provoke a militarization of the neighbor states in their borders with both Sudans to prevent a spillover of the violence. Thank you.
Provoke a
militarization of their borders with both Sudans.
I didn't get the word of provoke a...
Militarization.
A militarization of the borders.
Borders.
In some ways, you could a militarization of the borders with Sudan. And if you're meaning the neighboring country, the neighboring countries, you in the past when Sudan was unified, when the two republics were one. You did have sort of conflict between Uganda and Sudan as a whole. And that was because, of course, SPLM was very much supported by Uganda. But now, now that the Republic of South Sudan sort of is a buffer between the Republic of Sudan and Uganda, you don't have that. So in terms of the neighbors and the militarization, I don't see it. Eritrea has in the past supported the SPLM and supported rebel groups, and then they came to an agreement with the North some years ago that has reduced their support. Ethiopia has traditionally supported the SPLM, but Sudan People's Liberation Movement, but as a mediator, I think it's being seen by all sides as playing a very constructive role. So I don't see that from Ethiopia either. The Chad problem is about Darfurian rebels. It has less to do about the Republic of South Sudan. And so the militarization that's possible is, again, between the two countries, and it has to do with the north southern populations being in conflict with, being in conflict with the National Congress Party ruling government. And there, if the South Sudanese may choose to try to build, their military capability to defend their country, feeling that there's still a threat coming from the north. And I, for one, have talked about some air defense systems so that the type of raids, the air raids that the North has historically undertaken, they could defend themselves against. So there is a possibility of a militarization of the border between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan, but presumably this demilitarized zone will help to prevent that.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Hello. I was wondering your thoughts on Carney Ross and Independent Diplomat and the innovative way toward diplomacy and peacemaking, which may improve the current UN structure of just working more state to state versus the importance of working with groups within states for autonomy. And this seems like where we should be putting a lot of our emphasis toward. Do you think that this is a good case study in that, and that that is where we should be moving toward in our peacemaking?
Well, I don't know the specifics of the Carney Ross that you're talking about and the approach, but I do think that sort of third-track diplomacy and second-track diplomacy efforts where you're engaging communities and where it's non-governmental can play a positive and constructive role. Now, when you ask the question about working with groups for autonomy within countries, you know, autonomy is a word that can be defined in many different ways for what the actual arrangement is of those groups within that society and within that, you know, within that country. And so, you know, ultimately, a country, you know, maybe, you know, in the medium to short term, some type of autonomy, you know, is a stepping stone. But I would think that ultimately what you'd want is fully integrated citizens of these countries who have all the rights to every part of that country as, you know, anyone else. But, you know, I would welcome if you have a follow-up to help clarify what you have in mind.
Is there a follow-up there? I think we might have closed his line, but in any case, we are at the end of our time, and I know you're were so kind enough to fit this into your schedule, Ambassador Frazier, so let us close here. Thank you for sharing your insights with us today. We do appreciate it, and thanks to all of you for your terrific questions and comments.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Our next call will be on Wednesday, October 10th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. James Lindsay, CFR Senior Vice President and Director of Studies, will discuss foreign policy in the 2012 presidential campaign. So I hope that you will join us for that. We will be sending out the formal invitation in the next few days. So thank you all again for your participation, and we look forward to having you join us for future calls.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.